This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Godzilla was king of the monsters, and the movie was king of all monster movies. But the Godzilla that Americans have seen is considerably different from the original Japanese movie. In the spring, in honor of the film's 50th anniversary, it was released here in its original version for the first time. Godzilla is much more than a campy or scary monster movie. It's a very bleak, somber film with echoes of the firebombing and atom bombing of Japan and direct references to the perils of radiation. You probably know the basic story. A giant, angry reptile emerges from the ocean and stomps across Tokyo, breathing fire and destroying the city. A scientist believes that radiation from H-bomb tests turned a formerly peaceful sea creature into this monster. The American version of the film deleted about 40 minutes from the original to make it shorter and to make way for new footage that was added to make the film more marketable to American audiences. The new footage featured an American wire service reporter whose reports provide the narration for the story. The reporter was played by Raymond Burr, who went on to play Perry Mason. Here's how he opened the film.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few.
My guest Steve Riefel is the author of a book about the making of Godzilla and its many sequels. It's called Japan's Favorite Monster. I asked him why Raymond Burr's character was added to the American version and why some of the film's message was changed.
Well, this was, the mid-50s, a decade or so after the end of the war. I don't think there was a lot of sympathy for Japan, so the underlying message of the film may not have resonated so well with American audiences at that time. That having been said, I don't know that the distributors of the film in the United States had purely political motives. I think they were driven more by capitalism than anything else. And what they did was essentially disguise a Japanese film as an American one. And if you think about it, what they did was rather ingenious. They rented Raymond Burr for one day. The story goes that they paid him for one day's work and they kept him at the studio for 24 hours in order to film all of his scenes. They filmed everything in a little on a little soundstage on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. They hired Asian actors, some of whom posed as essentially body doubles for the Japanese actors. They used over-the-shoulder shots and whatnot to kind of pretend that Raymond Burr was actually speaking to members of the Japanese cast. And they rather effectively, if crudely, incorporated him into the Japanese film. And what it did was it created a very marketable giant monster movie of the variety that was so popular at that time.
Now, the ending is really changed. In the original Godzilla, the Japanese movie that is being released now in its full version in the States, the movie ends with the paleontologist saying, "I can't believe that Godzilla is the only survivor of his species. If we continue testing H-bombs, another Godzilla will one day appear somewhere in the world." What's the ending in the American version?
Well, you know, the giant bug, giant reptile, you know, atomic monster movies were extremely popular in the 1950s. I mean, I could run down a list of really wonderful titles like Tarantula, Them, Black Scorpion, Giant Claw, Giant Gila Monster, Giant Behemoth, The Amazing Colossal Man, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, and on and on and on. And what was the normal pattern in those films? Essentially, in the American atomic monster movies, the monsters were stand-ins for Cold War invaders. And at the end of the movie, there would be much celebration as the American military ultimately defeated these warriors, these monsters, with new and more powerful military might. Often there would be, you know, a new version of an atomic weapon that obliterated the monster. And the message was clear that no matter what the threat, you know, never fear, the American military is strong and will defend you. And what the American distributors of Godzilla did was essentially, if not completely, attempt to create an ending of that type. Raymond Burr's last line of the film was, you know, the menace was gone, but the whole world could wake up and live again. I think even in the Raymond Burr version of the film, the rather downbeat and poignant ending still shines through to a point. But in the original version, as you said, it's much more pessimistic. If we continue to test these H bombs, another Godzilla is going to appear somewhere in the world someday. To me, what that essentially means is, in our world, that someday, you know, one of these bombs is going to be used again. And if you look around us today, I mean, it's never been more true. I mean, we're just one accident away from a nuclear tragedy. And incidentally, the scientist's prediction was correct, wasn't it? Godzilla came back again and again and again and again. And that's why we're here talking about this today.
You know, watching the movie as an adult, I was thinking, well, you know, it's the H-bomb that's responsible for Godzilla, but it's the atomic bomb that was actually dropped on Japan. Why is it the H-bomb that the movie is so concerned with?
Well, the H-bomb testing program was in full effect at this time, and there was an incident in early 1954, the Lucky Dragon tragedy, and this is really the incident that may have been, you know, the most responsible for the creation of Godzilla. The Lucky Dragon was a Japanese fishing boat that set sail from its home port in Yaizu in January of 1954, and its voyage was ill-fated from the beginning. They were originally set to tuna fish in the waters off of Indonesia, but at the last minute, the owner of the boat ordered the fishing master to set sail instead for the waters off of Midway because he'd heard that there was great catches of albacore tuna to be had there. So in late February, they began fishing there, and on the morning of March 1st, 1954, in the pre-dawn hours, a few crew members were standing on the deck when they thought they saw the sun rising in the west. And what it turned out to be was an H-bomb test. Now, the crew of the boat had not been warned that they were drifting dangerously close to the Pacific Proving Ground, the H-bomb testing zone at the Marshall Islands. And even if they had known that they were close to the testing ground, they certainly did not know that a test was going to occur on that date. So as they stood there wondering what the heck this was, a few of the men who had served in the war started to get an eerie feeling, and the captain said, "Let's get the heck out of here." And by the time they reeled in their nets, they were being rained on with this sticky white ash, this radioactive fallout. And by the time they got back to Japan, many of the men were sick. The radio man later died of leukemia that year. It became a huge international incident. And in mid-March, after the boat had returned to port, and it was starting to be, this incident was starting to make waves in the press, Tomoyuki Tanaka, the producer of the film eventually, clipped a newspaper article and went to the head of production at Toho Studios and said, what if these H-bomb tests awakened an undersea creature that came on land and destroyed Japan? And that's really the genesis of Godzilla.
There are amazing scenes of destruction in Godzilla. You know, Godzilla in the movie, he's not just a victim of the hydrogen bomb, a victim in the sense that he's become bizarre and radioactive as a result of this, but he also is a kind of like metaphor for the force of hydrogen and atom bombs. And, you know, he breathes fire and he sets Tokyo ablaze. And the scenes of Tokyo burning are really disturbing, especially if you're a child watching it. Can you describe how those scenes were shot?
Well, the miniature sets of Tokyo, in some cases, were so large that they had to be built outside to accommodate the width and the dimensions of them. They were basically shot using miniature buildings constructed in 1/25th scale. And, of course, Godzilla, as we all know, is a man in a latex costume who tramples through the set. You know, for instance, when Godzilla destroys the clock tower in the Ginza, that is a very, very accurately detailed model the amount of care and detail that went into the construction of the miniature Tokyo is just amazing. When you witness Tokyo on fire, there's a great shot during the middle of Godzilla's long rampage. It's just amazing. The destruction, the death toll, is sort of unparalleled on screen.
One of the things that really intensifies all the effects of Godzilla, the sense of danger, the sense of destruction, is the score. It's a fantastic score. And worked into the score are the sounds of the monster growling and the really frightening sounds of the monster's footsteps reverberating. Tell us something about the composer of the score.
Well, Akira Ifukube, boy, what can I say? I think the score for Godzilla, of course I'm biased, but I think it's one of the greatest film scores of all time. And of course, the motifs in Godzilla were reused and reworked continually throughout the golden age of the series in the 50s and the 1960s. Mr. Ifukube is a highly regarded classical composer in Japan. He scored many, 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 many films, including several classics. And, you know, without Ifukube's music, I don't think Godzilla would have made the impact that it did. The music is synonymous with Godzilla, as is Godzilla's roar, which, by the way, Mr. Ifukube created through the manipulation of musical instruments and sound effects.
Why don't we hear part of the score, and you'll hear the monster's footsteps and the monster's roar worked into it. From the soundtrack of Godzilla. The sound of Godzilla's footsteps have always seemed to me to be the sound of impending doom, you know, because it's this thunderous reverberating sound and you get the feeling it's coming closer, you know, and so that's the feeling you're always left with when you hear these footsteps. It's like it's coming closer, the monster or the tragedy is approaching. How were those footsteps created?
Well, there are several accounts of how that was done. It seems to have been the most logical explanation seems to be a large drum that was beat and recorded and, you know, reverb effects added to it. I don't think it was anything, you know, technically sophisticated at that time. This film really had a make-it-up-as-you-go-along, you know, approach. Whatever needed to be done, the filmmakers found a way to do it.
How was the monster's roar created?
The monster's roar, boy, isn't that one of the greatest sound effects in movie history? Every kid knows it. I remember when I was a child, we used to try to imitate it to not too much success. It was created by rubbing a gloved hand, a leather-gloved hand, over the strings of a double bass, recording that sound and manipulating it, changing the speed. And that's what they came up with. And Godzilla's roar basically was created using the same sound effects, even up until now. Now it's digitally altered, but it basically sounds the same. If you recall, during the 1960s, Godzilla's roar became more of a high-pitched whine, but it's more or less the same sound.
Do you think that the director of Godzilla, Ishiro Honda, saw it as a monster film or saw it as, you know, a parable about the dangers of nuclear weapons?
I think it's a little bit of both. Mr. Honda had served in the Japanese military during World War II, and upon his return home after the war, he had visited Hiroshima and witnessed the aftermath of the destruction there, and he was deeply affected by that, and he said so on several occasions. Godzilla is Mr. Honda's most personal film by far. And you can see the imprint that the war left on him. He worked personally on the script, you know, and he spoke many, many times over the years about how his desire for this film, while it was an entertainment film by and large, but his desire was to send a message, not an indictment of America. The monster really, that's another difference between Godzilla and American monster movies of the same time period. The American monsters usually are stand-ins, as I said, for Cold War enemies. Godzilla is not really a stand-in for America. It is more an indictment of the nuclear age. And Honda's hope was that somehow this film would inspire people to think about disarmament. I think today, if he were still alive, he'd be very disappointed that, you know, nuclear weapons are possessed by more nations than ever before.
You've seen all of the Godzilla sequels. Which do you think are the worst?
Well, the film that is fairly universally regarded as the worst of the Godzilla series is called Godzilla vs. Megalon. And, you know, this film has unfortunately been probably seen more widely than any other Godzilla film. It came out in 1973 in Japan, 76 roughly in the United States. And NBC actually broadcast it in prime time with John Belushi hosting it and introducing segments of the film wearing a Godzilla costume himself. It's crudely made. It's a lot of fun for laughs, but it's really not science fiction, you know, in any sense of the word. And yet this film really has massive exposure, relatively speaking. And I think a lot of people who just assume Godzilla is this campy, you know, monster that is good for little more than wrestling matches and goofy antics are thinking of films like this one. That's why the release of this, the original Godzilla in its uncut form, in this, you know, quote-unquote director's cut version, is so important. Because Godzilla didn't start out that way. It had serious intentions. And yes, it's an entertainment film. Yes, it's not meant to be taken too seriously. We're not talking about, you know, Citizen Kane here. I recognize that. But nevertheless, the original film and the filmmakers who created it had higher aspirations than something like Godzilla versus Megalon. And let us not forget that.
Well, Steve Riefel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Steve Riefel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. In the spring, the original Japanese version of Godzilla was released in America for the first time in honor of the film's 50th anniversary.